Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Bonulli. Today we have Larry McDonald and Ira Harris. Larry is the founder and editor of the Bear Traps Report, an independent macro research platform focusing on global, political, and systemic risk with actionable trade ideas. The firm also does a live institutional Bloomberg chat with over 650 institutional investors. And as a former vice president of distressed debt and convertible securities trading at Lehman Brothers, wrote a book on the fall of the investment bank titled A Colossal Failure of Common Sense. New York Times bestselling author and Academy Award on Inside Job. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. It's always a pleasure. It's a pleasure to sit down with Larry. I read his stuff when it's available out there. So
great. I thought we'd do a focus on your recent article, Larry, on the market that takes a focus on secular shift from tech growth stocks to value and commodity stocks. Can you elaborate on that perspective?
Well, thank you very much, gents. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I hope you had a wonderful holiday over the last weekend. The biggest thing, so our partner in Washington is ACG Analytics. And what we've been doing over the last 15 years is we will typically take the institutional investors around the Hill, spend a lot of time with the different, you know, Senate and House leadership. And over the last year, even last couple of years, we've really, there's a tone that's coming out of Washington that's a very, very powerful tone. And if you talk to anybody that's close to Susan Rice or Barack Obama, Chuck Schumer, these people, the anger that they express around what happened in 2010 to the Democrats is still very biting. It's a real pain. There was a lot of pain there for the party, and they lost 63 seats in the House, the most since the late 20s or 1930s. And so, if you talk to people on the Hill, the fact that the Democrats have the House, the Senate, and the White House with the power of reconciliation, I'm very, very sure that they want to go, you know, full throttle on the fiscal, not do, you know, kind of a partial fiscal plan that they did in 2008-9, more like 2009-10. And they really want to go all in and get as much fiscal spending in as possible, almost an attempt to buy votes, right? You want to be providing lots of relief to families out of the crisis. And then they want to use that capital to, in modern monetary theory, in other words, have the Fed have their back, to really buy the votes and win the midterms. If they win the midterms, then they won't have the, you know, horrific austerity experience that they went through in 2010, 11, 12. You got to remember 2010, after that victory by the Republicans in the House, in 2011, 12, 13, there was the budget deficit went from $1 trillion down to $350 billion. And the Republicans eventually took, because of that austerity regime, eventually took 9 Senate seats in 2014. So bottom line is we have the same team in the White House now that was there that experienced this blow, you know, this real battle with austerity and the Republicans. And so the Democrats are going to go out of their way by using the most creative, historical, disruptive techniques that have never been used before. Around reconciliation, we could see 2 to 3 reconciliation bills this year, which never happened before. It's a very aggressive move, and it's going to change asset prices for the next decade.
And you see that as the driver for move to value and commodity-related equities businesses?
Yes, because as we laid out to clients, we laid this thesis out in the third and fourth quarter, and then especially with an emphasis after the election. But people forget there's two types of investment playbooks. There's the deflationary playbook, and that's your bonds and your long-term equity cash flows. So your NASDAQ stocks do really well in periods of austerity, Brexits, trade wars, COVID. So we've had a very long period of like six or seven events back to back to back to back that have been extremely positive for deflationary assets. And now we're really coming the other way, where we're coming out of the Brexit regime, we're coming out of the trade war regime, we're coming out of the COVID regime, we're coming out of the austerity regime. The Democrats want to spend another probably $3 trillion on top of the $2 trillion that's already been passed this year. So we're looking at a potential $5 trillion a year. And so you want to be long emerging market equities, commodity equities, commodity cyclicals, and you want to be long value stocks, especially value stocks that are more globally exposed.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I think this move has been taking place starting last April and May, which we've discussed many times, Richard. And I think that this administration, yes, they don't want to make the mistakes of what they consider the Larry Summer mistakes. And of course, Summers is out there making noise because he's a rejected lover, so he may as well throw crap wherever he can. But this has been going on since, I see it through that China has reversed course here. And this is what the Fed is going to miss. And this is what Yellen is going to miss from all the things that she's been talking about. The Chinese have been stockpiling commodities. Now, you may not see it, but I see it in the yuan, because the stronger the yuan is, to me, it signals that the Chinese are moving and trying to rebalance the economy away from totally an export-oriented economy to a more domestic consumption base, which will put ever higher prices, not on raw material goods, but if the amount of their exports start to decline, the greatest disinflationary mechanism for the last 25 years begins to change. And I think that's what we've been seeing. Now, I agree with Larry that going forward, I want to be in those stocks, but I wanted to be in ag stocks, mining stocks, high quality, by the way. I don't buy just baskets of stuff. I try to find the best ones that I can. And it certainly paid me through sitting through dividend. So I think there's more to go? I think there's more to go. I love the ag sector. That has proved its resilience. It was so unloved last March and April that there were many interesting true values. And they've been played out. And I think that if the yuan goes press 6.25 and we can get through there, I think people are going to be really shocked at what it signals to the global environment. And again, how the central banks are going to wish, I won't say that they want inflation, so they will herald, of course, it'll be transitory, but it'll be more a result of what's going on from China.
Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts, Larry, on central bank policies of the major central banks? Do you see any trends, in particular, your thoughts on yield curve control?
Well, I think that the Fed's in a spot where the deflationary forces of the yuan in China have been pretty powerful over the last 6 years. And the last thing they want is a weak yuan, because we went. Remember the the Fed was trying to, in 2014, 15, 16, the Fed was trying to exit their accommodative posture. And all that means is, you know, open the door to hiking rates and opening the door to reversing the balance sheet. And that caused $1 trillion, probably a lot more, to leave China, and the Chinese currency weakened, the rest of the world dramatically weakened. And what the Fed's risk managers have done a poor job around understanding the deflationary impacts of a stronger dollar. And I completely agree that the last thing the Fed wants now, and they've learned, is a weaker yuan. They want a stronger yuan to stabilize the global economy, because there's $65 trillion of GDP outside the United States and about $20 trillion in. So when I was growing up many, many years ago, the U.S. was almost, you know, 40, 45% of global GDP. Now the U.S. is a $20 trillion machine, but the rest of the world is the $64, $65 trillion machine. And so the problem is, with all the trade that's in dollars, every single time the Fed has tried to exit, or every single time the market starts to believe the Fed's in an exit plane, the dollar strengthens, and the deflationary forces globally from that and the inequality forces have been very profound in the United States. Like, talking about stronger dollar essentially delivered the 2016 election to Trump. You had hundreds of thousands of jobs in the Rust Belt that were eliminated in that period. So your inequality with a strong dollar has been very, very profound. And the Fed is now on an inequality social justice regime that is much more pronounced, and I think that meets the eye. So they're going to try to take that social justice inequality Fed and turn over a new leaf, and not put themselves. And the last thing they want is to really go down that inequality route again. So if they can contain the dollar, that's the key to global growth and the key to stabilizing the global economy after this incredible shock that was COVID. You know, it's a World War II type shock. And so the one way to do that is to promise more accommodation through things like yield curve control, things like forward guidance, using calendar guidance. So bottom line is, the Fed wants to stay more accommodative than the rest of the world central banks, whereas in the previous decade, they were pulling back accommodation much, much, much faster than the rest of the world. And you had multiple periods, 2013, 2015, of dollar strength, which obliterated the global economy on numerous occasions and came back to bite the Fed in the rear end. And so the last thing they want is to repeat that. So that all of this, on top of the political forces we talked about earlier, all of this combines to, once again, your commodities, your value decade. You want to be, you know, reducing exposure to the FANGs and to tech stocks, and you want to be increasing exposure to commodities, copper, gold, uranium, platinum, and your, what I call the sexy metals, your metals that are exposed to the green revolution.
Great. Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Yeah, I agree so much with Larry talked about. Yield curve control, let's back up. The dollar is absolutely right, and they finally woke up to it, and I think you see it in Richard Clarida's speeches all through after they did the Powell pivot in the spring of 2019. Clarida absolutely talks about the more – looking at the dollar. And then you saw what happened a year ago, which is when it went to opening up swap lines for dollars with central banks that they hadn't had that relationship, because they're trying to prevent a rise in the dollar. You know, as we've talked about, Richard, and blogged about, it was May 25th of 2020, when Wolfgang Schäuble did that famous pivot himself, over that Memorial Day weekend, and he said that going down the route, the road of making loans to problem European countries, especially in the southern realm, was like giving them more stones, whereas if you gave them grants, it was truly giving them bread, which was truly an amazing volta face for somebody like Wolfgang Schäuble. So we've seen that, and the dollar was trading around 108 then. Of course, it went up to about 122.5 in the euro. We have some now we're, as the yields have sprung out again, it's almost 2% differential on the U.S.-German 10-year. So some of the short-term pressure, downside pressure to the dollar has come off as people are chasing up. And I stress this nominal yields. So, I mean, that's the world we should lie. But I think the Fed and Yellen certainly understand, I think Larry is dead right, that a stronger dollar undermines it, especially because, and that's what they learned last year. The vast amount of debt, no matter how it's priced at, as far as interest costs, the amount of dollar debt is so huge that any time that the global economies, especially with involved with the emerging markets, I think there's $11 trillion in corporate emerging market debt that has to be financed. Well, there's a rush to the dollar and it drives the dollar higher. So they actually got out in front of it last year. And I think that was one of the better things the Fed did, because for so long, they tried to disavow, you know, they had a dual mandate, which I always laughed at. I've been laughing at that since graduate school, never believed in the Phillips curve, as I continually stress, because it lacked an international component. And I think that's why they're putting it to bed. So while they benefited in their view about inflation because of the unleashing of a massive Chinese workforce upon the world, which, as Larry points out, led to what we saw in 2016, especially, that people were frustrated and feeling so left out. And a lot of that was because wages were impacted, but the ability to make money in financial terms increased geometrically on a go because of the free flow of money around the world. So I think all these things are in play here. But I think, I don't know, the Fed, you know, the Fed, when Brainard was busy making speeches last year, all the way up until August, and it changed at the Jackson Hole when Powell all of a sudden stopped talking about yield curve control. So it's like the Fed does not want to go down that rabbit hole, because first of all, it'll really put pressure on the dollar, because with the U.S. as the world reserve currency, yield curve control, this is not 1946 or 1947 or 1948. The world is a far different place. And when people make those comparisons, yes, I know I've read Meltzer's history of the Accord over and over again over many years. So this is not the same environment. The dollar will get hit pretty good if they embark, because that's, and it's like the Powell Fed has woken up to that. But I thought that, you know, that's why Leo Brainard waits in the wings, because she's a big proponent. All you do is have to go back and read her speeches from last year of yield curve control. Now, if they don't go to yield curve control, and I think Larry agrees wholeheartedly, we're going to have full blown out MMT. Because you can't, you have to have one or the other. You can't be doing all this borrowing and have the long, we've never been in a situation where the long end of the curve has wagged the entire dog. Never. When yield curves have traditionally steepened, yes, it usually puts pressure on the dollar. The dollar historically weakens because it reflects that the Fed has been behind the curve. Just like equity markets still perform well when the long end is going up, but the short end is not moving. So you get a steepening of the curve. And then once the Fed realizes that it's been lagging, then they start to raise short-term rates and everything starts to reverse course. But I agree when Larry uses that phrase, social justice minister. Well, I say social justice minister or the minister of social justice. There's no question about it. Because once you go down that path, you know, like Draghi famously talked about, whatever it takes, Powell and Yellen and so many people at the Fed use, well, through no fault of their own. Once you embark down that path, and I take the Fed seriously when they discuss that, through no fault of their own, you are on the path of social justice, and that's how you're running your monetary policy. I don't think there's that inflation, as they keep telling you, is transient. And if somebody sent me a question, so Larry, if you saw headline inflation for 2 or 3 months print at 4 or 5%, what do you think the market's response would be?
Well, yeah, 2 or 3 months at 4 or 5, that the people would freak out. And that's when the long end, you know, I completely agree with you. They don't want to throw out like yield curve control like it's willy-nilly. I completely agree. But what you just described in that environment, they would be forced into some type of yield curve control, because if you just do the math on the duration losses, there's like 110, 120 trillion of bonds on Earth below 1.75%. So the entire planet's wealth is priced in bonds at much, 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 much lower coupons now. So 100 basis points move in yields is literally 8 times to 10 times more destruction to global wealth than it ever was a decade ago. So people have to understand the convexity of the bond market today is a much different situation. So that's what I mean. It's like, what's going to happen is the Biden team, in an effort to, you know, make good on that 2010 disaster in the midterms, and you got to look back the last 100 years, every single midterm election for the first incoming president has been a disaster. And they're only up right now 5-6 seats in the House, and the Senate's completely, you know, tied 50-50. So the last thing they want is to repeat that 2010 disaster. And so they're going to spend aggressively, which essentially forces the Fed into yield curve control or aggressive MMT. I don't really see a big difference. And maybe Ira, you think you're stronger, much stronger there than I am, but I really don't see a big difference. I guess in yield curve control, you're stating that, okay, we're going to keep the 10-year below 2%, you know, for 18 months or whatever it is. Whereas aggressive MMT, you're just going in and maybe expanding the 120 billion a month to maybe 160 billion a month, something crazy like that. I mean, I just don't see it. I don't see a big difference between yield curve control and aggressive MMT.
Sorry, Richard, I'm going to answer.
Go ahead.
I agree with you about that. And it's interesting, because when you do get into the depths of MMT, you know, what Warren Mosler had originally talked about, and even what's her name, Stephanie Kelton, who picks up on it, is MMT is reliant upon, as they say, an enlightened electorate who would then see it in their best interest to raise taxes. You know, that's the ultimate bottom line. And yet, you know, as you're a very good follower of American politics, and you know, you want to talk about a third rail, raise taxes to pay for that stuff and see what the outcome, you know, if it was the Democrats in office, they'd get crushed by that. Because even people who, you know, may see a lot of agreement when it comes to whatever narrow-minded politics they want to get to, when they respond to it, well, they understand about their taxes going up. Oh, and I'm going to vote to raise my taxes for all the spending that I created. I don't think that's a very doable proposition for my watching American politics for as long as I have. So that's where it falls apart. So I agree. And there's no getting away from yield curve control. Now, I believe that Janet Yellen is very disingenuous, because her favorite metric when it comes to this is, of course, the percentage of interest of the federal government interest payments relative to GDP. So she continues to harp on, well, they're so low, they're so low, they're so low, they're so low. Yes, but I think Larry and I would ask, where's the break point for them to start to get nervous, especially on the long end? Because we know that 80% of the offerings from the Treasury have been, I believe, at 3 years or less. So everything is front-loaded. Well, what's going to happen to all discretionary spending and what that budget situation is going to look like? if all of a sudden the borrowing costs were to increase dramatically.
Exactly. Before COVID, 65% of the budget was entitlements and interest. Entitlements and interest. That's entitlements of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And that was before COVID. So now you're looking at probably 70 to 72, maybe 74% of the budget is entitlements and interest payments. So they have no room for error here. They have to contain yields because very quickly, if yields get out of control, then the budget would be, you know, almost 100% entitlements and interest payments.
Yeah, you're right. Right. So I don't know how, you know, and she's selling it as meaning Yellen, who I have a lot of respect for, but she, I think it's a very, you know, okay, I can do those metrics too. And I find the numbers, but where does it all begin to really fall apart? And can you imagine if that number increases fairly dramatically, how it impacts the politics? Because once you start looking at discretionary spending, and we're not even getting to the military end of it, because, you know, the Biden administration is making all kinds of noise. And are they going to be prepared to back up to the extent that they're making noise about? Because that'll, you know, military spending and this administration's background team, some of the people, Larry, that you initially talked, they have no stomach for that. Can you imagine if they were cutting programs to spend more on defense spending? Wow. You know, I can tell you what 2022 elections will look like.
Yeah, that forces in a lot more bond buying too.
Yeah, that's true.
Good points. And in terms of this environment, if we focus on emerging markets, you wrote and mentioned about emerging markets, Larry. What are your thoughts on South Korea, Chile, and Brazil that you mentioned in the article? Why those in particular?
Well, I love, you know, commodity. I like countries where your commodity producing countries is a large portion of GDP. So 65% of the Chilean economy is connected to commodities. Lower in Brazil, but it's, you know, Chile is the largest copper producer in the world, and everybody knows by now, it's kind of old news, but the amount of copper that's in electric vehicles. I mean, if Tesla is really a $700 billion company, then copper is probably at least a double, if not a triple, from here. So your commodity producing countries like Chile are in a great spot. They do have an election next year. We're watching that very carefully because that can really screw up an investment thesis. If you get that wrong, you need a market-friendly government in there. But higher commodity prices will definitely help the market-friendly players. And so bottom line is I want to be long commodity producing countries in Brazil and Chile. South Korea is, you know, you just got, you know, the fastest growing technology hub in the world, pretty much. And your valuations there are pretty cheap relative to the United States. So those are spots that we like a lot. I mean, we're definitely worried about a situation with Taiwan and China, and China's probably going to test the Biden administration early on, and definitely worried about something in the Ukraine where, once again, Putin makes a move toward more territory. And so you're seeing some things. If you just look at kind of between the lines and the tea leaves and the news cycles, there's definitely some things going on in both of those potential hotspots. And as I alluded to, the Biden administration is kind of, in some ways, you know, is poking a bear in those spots. So that's, you want to keep some powder dry. We want to have a decent cash position to take advantage of a pullback in emerging markets. But you could have, you know, a short-term shock that would create some buying opportunities. So I think you take a one-third, two-thirds position now in some of these EM countries, and then just be prepared to add into some weakness.
Great. And Ira, your thoughts?
Yeah, so with that, I've been out there for a long time, and even on with Richard, we talked about this quite a bit. I've always thought, and of course, anybody who has studied Asia, and I studied it pretty in depth when I was in graduate school, and you understand Taiwan has always, of course, been the issue. Hong Kong is a sideshow and just was testing the waters because of the 50-year agreement, whatever. It's Taiwan is the proverbial tripwire, even more so than I think the demilitarized zone between North Korea and South Korea, because that you can blast your way over anyway, but that's the tripwire. Will the Chinese push it? Well, right now, just this came up. Calls grow louder to boycott Beijing Olympics. This just came out. So somebody asked me this question, Larry, who respects you. So you're sitting at your desk and you hear that China is entering Taiwan. How do you see? We'll get to it. How would you trade that? And what would the effect be for the world? Because, that is a very, and I think the Biden administration is putting a lot of pressure on China, and will China, as Larry's poked that bear. And I think the analysis on many of the people who sit in this Biden administration is just dead wrong, because the Russians and the Chinese are looking at the world, and they're looking right now. The Chinese always switch. If you go back to the 60s and 70s, early 80s, the key fear for the Chinese was the Soviets. So much so that in order to deter the Soviets, China invaded Vietnam. Most people don't understand that these have been issues for a long, long time. But now the Russians and Chinese, because of their frustration with deal with the U.S. sanctions, which again, between the Treasury and the other groups, that they have sanctions. But I couldn't stand Mnuchin because that's all he could speak about was sanctions. He has a hammer and everything's a nail, but that's so wrong. And you're seeing it, because why is Russia ramping up pressure on the Donbas region in Ukraine and putting more pressure? Is it because they're working together and going, okay, where do you want to get involved here, meaning to the U.S.? So I think the U.S. has to be very, very, very careful here. And, Larry, how would you react to any type of escalation militarily in Taiwan?
Well, we've been in our institutional Bloomberg chat, so it's a live chat on the Bloomberg terminal. And as we mentioned, we probably have about 600 to 700 institutional investors in there, and a lot of them are old friends and contributors. We can run things by them. And we've asked this question a bunch of times over the last couple of months. And some of the favorite trades would be, some might be harder to put on than others, but obviously short the South Korean won, long credit default swaps on South Korea, Taiwan semiconductor put spreads. And one thing is just look at Intel. Why is Intel spending, I think it's like $12 billion of CapEx on this new U.S. facility. So you have a number of companies that, like Intel, that are reshoring and building massive, literally, if you just look at the CapEx budget of Intel over the last decade, the amount of money they're spending in, I think it's in Arizona, is extremely meaningful. And it just tells you that, these guys are really brilliant people, and they're probably concerned not just about the wake up call from the trade war and how that can disrupt supply chains, but they're also looking at, okay, we're probably too exposed to that part of the world. And so for Intel to be spending that kind of capital, it tells you that they're worried about something. So Intel would be a near term casualty as well. Taiwan Semi, potentially Micron. I'd have to do more work on some of the other ones, but those were some of the trades that the institutional investors have been talking about.
Well, yeah, that's, and I'm down here in Arizona, so it is Arizona where they're in Glendale, I believe, getting prepped for the next leg of this. So, yes, and no, thank you for, I'm glad. And I saw Niall Ferguson's recent piece, which I found kind of interesting because last year when Hong Kong heated up, he interviewed Kissinger, and I took him to task in my blog that he never asked Kissinger. You could watch the YouTube interview. He never asked Kissinger once about Taiwan. Never. And then he writes this article a week or two ago for Bloomberg talking about the significance of Taiwan. So this is definitely a hot issue. Now, we don't know what the U.S. is doing through back channel, but I keep raising this issue too, because as the United States ramps up its rhetoric, again, as I point out with Russia, the rest of the world is going ho-hum. And what is really interesting is that the Islamic world, especially Iran, just signed a 25-year strategic agreement with the Chinese as they sell more and more energy to the Chinese. So the Iranians, who are supposedly the protector of all things Islamic in the world, has no problem ramping up China, even as the Uyghurs suffer more and more. And even the Saudis, you know, on March 27th, announcement of that 25-year strategic agreement, the Saudis, now this is a Chinese phrase, so it shows you how deep the Arab nations are with China. Is they use that, well, it's an internal matter. And that's what the Chinese want everybody to speak to. The Uyghurs, an internal matter. Taiwan, an internal matter. I mean, this is a new rhetoric. It goes back to Mao when they looked at things. And don't tell us how to run, because that's the anti-colonial impulse that underlies so much of what China thinks and their timeline. And they remember what the Western nations did to China. It's not that long ago in their minds. And they don't ever want to be lectured to or told what to do. So we're going down this course, but I still am amazed that the State Department thinks that they run the world. This is not 1946. It's a far different world, and its ability to be more dynamic in responses to U.S. actions is growing every day.
Larry, any thoughts on precious metals?
Well, okay, so we like gold and silver here. They've been through a pretty nasty sell-off because the amount of bonds for sale relative to inflation expectations has gotten out of whack, and the stimulus from this $2 trillion bill really wasn't in the economy. So as a big blob of treasuries in March and February came for sale, the inflation expectations hadn't caught up with that yet. And so with gold, you really, what crushes gold is when bond sales, if you think of like two cars moving, you know, bond sales were moving at 95 miles an hour in terms of their, you know, just the size. Imagine like a snake swallowing a Volkswagen. That's the type of, you're talking about $4 trillion of bond sales this year, about $2 trillion more than QE. And so the market had to absorb and kind of come to reality with that kind of an agenda. So the bond sales overpowered through higher yields, inflation expectations, so five-year forwards are moving higher. But they're only moving, and 10-year inflation expectations are moving higher, but they're moving about 60 miles an hour versus 90 miles an hour for the bond sale. So that's a bad recipe for gold. The other thing is that all the gold investors in the world are, you know, have that memory of the 2013 to 14 taper tantrum, and the drawdown in gold and silver there, 2011, 12, 13. Was so nasty that as the Fed was trying to, you know, come out of their policy path relative to the rest of the world, central banks, the Fed was literally like five times more hawkish than the rest of the world. And so those things have gold and silver investors like very, you know, I guess you call them their fingers on the trigger. In other words, it pushed out a lot of the fast, hot money. But now, with the Fed, that's as Ira and I have discussed, is more on an inequality agenda, that you get more accommodation now, longer term than they did in the last cycle. And so therefore, if there's anything like even a white paper on yield curve control or any hints of it through Fed speeches, then I just really believe that in this cycle, gold and silver have one more big leg up, like potentially 50, 60, 100% move in this cycle before we go into a taper tantrum problem. So in this cycle, you just have a Fed that's focused on, you know, I think inequality, like I said, social justice, all that should, and then the $2 trillion fiscal should be in the economy, where a good chunk of it's in the economy now through the stimulus checks, but the rest of it will work its way through the economy through the year. And so inflation expectations will start to pick up once people, you know, see that those two more reconciliation bills that are coming down the pike. And so bottom line is silver, especially with the connection to copper and the amount of electric vehicles in the world that are on course to be produced, the amount of silver and copper that's in these vehicles is a much bigger industrial demand driver than it's ever been. So all of these things make this cycle for silver, the Hecla mining, SLV, ETF, SILs, the miners, all these things make that space a lot more attractive. So your convexity to the upside this cycle is versus the risk reward, to me, looks much better skewed than the last cycle because of the industrial demand driver, number one, and because number two, because you have a more social justice, inequality driven Fed that's going to try to maintain more accommodation for a longer period. And the Biden administration that is dedicated toward buying votes into that 2022 midterm. All of that leads us to believe that this is a great bump. Buy the dips in gold and silver all day long with both hands.
Okay. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I agree. I'm looking for, I don't forecast levels. I've been doing this for 34 years next month. And it's such a silly game, because when you're right, nobody cares. And when you're wrong, they'll throw it back in your face. So, Joel Granville, I'm not. So I think that the gold, silver, and it's an interesting thing, because the gold, silver, it had coming off of last year's absolute debacle in the March, April period, when it was mass liquidation. Everybody was worried about a global deflation outcome when gold, silver ran up to all-time highs of 120, maybe 121. And now we're sitting back here at around, you know, what is, a 69 and a quarter as we look on the ratio. I'm really looking for this one to, based on the underlying fundamentals that Larry talks about, to improve quite dramatically. There seems to be a seller in the silver market. I think some of that is a remnant of the Reddit crowd when they tried to squeeze silver prices higher. I think that they could make a difference in that world. They couldn't. They ran right into the banks and legitimate hedgers and beat them back with a stick, you know, after the, when was that? January 29th. And they tried to squeeze it. We got over $30 for a brief period. And then that gave it up. And silver struggled in here back and forth. But I think that's right. I think it has a lot more to say about it. This is just the world in which, you know, we live in. Now, today the world's full of talk about, you know, the Chinese being the first with a central bank digital currency. Well, you know, I believe that if the Chinese they don't have enough credibility right now in the investment world, in the financial world, to move in any capacity on the dollar. They just don't. It's just not there. It's very hard to trust them in many ways. And if you believe in the autocratic nature of the central of the Chinese Communist Party and the Politburo, Central Planning Commission. So I believe that if the Chinese were to go to a digital currency that they wanted to accept it, some of it would have to be backed by precious metal. And, you know, historically, I believe that if the Chinese do that, maybe they'll move back to, you know, maybe a digital yuan will be backed 10 or 20% by silver and or gold. You pick, you know, but China, of course, again, what did Britain do to break China? What did the UK do in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, opium wars? And that a lot of that is still in the Chinese conversation. Well, they broke silver in order to break China. I always pay attention to that because this will not be as the status quo thinkers believe it's going to be. I don't think so, because China is going to need more to establish some credibility and wean the world off a dollar standard. So I'm with Larry for so many reasons, but that one just lingers out there for me.
And just a final question on ESG. You mentioned in your article, Larry, like ESG focused types of equities and commodities. You actually make a reference to coal, like clean coal. You can elaborate on that.
Well, you know, the problem with social political policy drivers is you see this over and over again over the last decade, where something like ESG comes along or migration in Europe, and it's backed with like Pollyannish, beautiful, well-intentioned philosophy, right? But when you try to get into the policy, the disruption to the working class, middle-class Americans or middle-class Europeans can be just so disruptive. So you have the Davos crowd that is literally like just in a madness of crowds in terms of just getting into a certain philosophy without looking at the unintended consequences of the impact on millions and millions, if not, you know, 100 million middle-class people, or and globally at least potentially a billion, hundreds of millions of middle-class people. And so if you think of the commodity space, the ESG thing is so unsustainable because it has a great, beautiful long-term view. But what happens is the Davos crowd, and we've seen this over and over again, especially with migration and immigration throughout the world, they try to jam things into a very short period of time, and next thing you know, something that makes really good sense over 20 years or even 10, they try to jam a lot in. So I just think that this ESG, if you talk to any banker on Wall Street, and I'm a former Lehman trader, so we know a lot of, our book now is in 12 languages on the Lehman crisis, and so we know a lot of bankers around the world and a lot of the institutional investors in our chat. If you look at the availability of credit for non-ESG compliant companies, you're talking about just a really uneven playing field, to the point where there's been so much credit availability to ESG plays and no credit availability to oil, gas, and coal, or very little relative to previous years, that it's setting up for a big supply shock where you have a very limited supply of commodities that support middle-class Americans, middle-class people around the world for energy consumption. I mean, think about India, for example, the most aggressive, most powerful demand on earth is coming out of India. You're talking about the fastest growing fossil fuel demand in the world. I mean, literally seven times faster than in developed markets, and especially for diesel fuel for the, you know, the mopeds and things like that. So you're talking about an ESG policy globally that's really going to punish the little guy, and a lot of these well-intentioned progressive Democrats. It's really an unsustainable path because they claim to be supporting the common man and the little guy, but a lot of these policies are, when we see the unintended consequences, are really going to create some problems. And so I think you want to be long some of these coal names that are going to benefit from this supply shock, and demand for fossil fuels and coal is a lot more global sustainable. In other words, to put through, to get to the green meadow, you need a path through coal, uranium. You need a path through a lot of these commodities. So nuclear power and the existing coal plants on the planet are going to go away over 20, 30 years for sure, but they're going to go away a lot slower. And then met coal, if you're going to have a revolution in infrastructure, met coal is still, I mean, hydrogen-based steel production is like 10 years away. I'm sorry, it's just not here yet. I wish it was here, but you know, and they write these articles and these white papers if it's here, but it's not here. Okay, so met coal is you need that met coal engine for the infrastructure revolution that the Democrats, you know, want to spend all this money on. So you have it, just you just think about it. You got this group of people. It's out here where it's like $2 trillion here, $2 trillion there, infrastructure, ho, ho, ha, ha. And they just don't do the math on the sustainability of the policy. Because if you're going to do all that infrastructure spending, and if you're going to do all of this, if you're going to spend all this money on electric vehicles and create all these tax benefits for electric tax credits for electric vehicles, then you need the commodities to support this. If not, these you're going to have massive mispricings. And it's just, I just see this, like, we've gone from a free market economy for pretty much like 10 years ago to this oligopolistic, like, you know, just big government controlled by interest groups. And it's just setting up for a lot of dislocations. And so I think the whole ESG thing is going to backfire in a pretty nasty way through really disrupting the cost and the standard of living for a lot of middle class people. And so I see a move away from ESG over the next year. Not as if ESG is going to go away. I just think we've overdosed on ESG for now, and the credit availability to non-ESG compliant companies is going to expand, and I see a big, you know, boom for those types of companies in uranium, nuclear power, and in coal.
Yeah, exactly. And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, I'm sure it will just enrich Warren Buffett because of those assets that aren't ESG desired. We'll just push some really high quality companies down to levels where he'll go, this is pretty good. The photo ops are great, but the underlying situation will make Buffett wealthier. That much I can guarantee you. More than that, I can't. You know, I'm running for the CME board again, so I can't, because you know, on any corporate board, ESG is a hot button issue. But Larry is right in many, many ways. And you look at Germany, who made to me, you know, people love Merkel. I have never been a Merkel fan. I think she has been bested by Sarkozy, to be bested by Sarkozy is not a badge of honor unless you were bested by Oliver Sarkozy. She shut down the German nuclear facility. And for a country that in which the green presence has always been strong, especially as the Social Democrats have lost their grip and their respectability. So that's put them behind the eight ball. Why Britain didn't really go full throttle on Hinkley Point, because they could have financed it through the ECB by issuing those bonds, which the ECB would have bought before the Brits exited. Stay tuned on the real outcome for Brexit. I think the Canadian economy does very well here. For everything that Larry spoke about, I think Canada, well, if they can overcome Trudeau's desires to be loved by everybody, they would be, you know, they can get some of themselves in gear here. But there, you know, all these things the world is very dynamic, and I think, you know, if there's an outcome from what we're talking about, is that there's that dynamicism, and just because it's nice political optics about ESG. Better rethink it through on every one of these. You know, I don't buy ETFs for the most part, unless I'm buying them in foreign countries, because I always think that I can pick accordingly and I'm willing to do the work. If I can't do the work, why am I even bothering? So there, and then to as a warning sign of where all this goes, I'd like to know, and I mean, we discussed this with Richard Long with Louis Gavet, and what is the tipping point for when the Fed gets nervous on the long end? And the long end is, that's a big part of it. So if you get this inflation and people start attacking the long end, the Fed, of course, have to go into yield curve control because they just won't be able to jawbone it. Because right now, the market has been at war with the Fed because you go where you can, right? I mean, why would I sell 5 years and lower when I could sell 10 and 30 years and I know I'm not fighting the Fed to the same degree I'm fighting on the shorter duration in the belly of the curve, so to speak. Well, that's going to be, to me, a tremendous break point. Where does this go and where does it force the Fed's hand? And when we get there, well, if we see outright YCC, that will be that the Fed is beginning to lose its nerve. As Larry's piece that I read that was on posted on that Swiss group, who I get their mailings every day. When that does take place, I think the metals really take off. I think that's what the metals are waiting for. And you know, I wanted to answer Larry with that because right now as the algorithms are set up to track the 10 and 30 year yields in the United States against various asset classes. First, they tried it with the equity markets, but they realized that that's not, it's the short end that really drives it. But they're trading the dollar off of 10 and 30 year yields, which again, this is a new phenomenon. We've never done this. It's always been on the, you know, currency values are much more susceptible to short rates than they have been to long rates because that's, you know, steepening yield curves are bearish of currency, except in this environment. And I'm not stupid enough to say, well, it's never the same. And this is the driving dynamic that we're going to experience here. And again, if you look historically, if I did a 50-year study recently, the real yield, and again, not nominal, real yields over the last 50 years have averaged on 10-year U.S. debt 2.4% in real yields. Think about that. We've been negative, and we're you know, depending on whose metrics you use, you're probably, let's be kind and say you're at zero now. So you have to think through this in those terms to see where we're going and how we're going. So that's what I will be focusing on. And of course, China has my supreme attention.
Well, great, insightful discussion, gentlemen. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Larry?
Well, if you're an institutional investor on Bloomberg, just look us up. It's Lawrence McDonald, the Bear Traps Report on Bloomberg. On Twitter, we're at ConvertBond, and I think we're approaching 70,000 followers on Twitter. And our website's the Bear Traps Report. We do have a new retail offering called The Turning Point that's coming out once a week where we kind of recap what we see from the institutional side in trying to democratize information flow for the retail investor. And that's on the website, thebeartrapsreport.com.
Awesome. And Ira.
Still writing notes from underground, and I appear on this site, Financial Protection Authority, quite a bit, as well with some others. I'm still working. It is a full-time, I'm going to be 68 years old, but I love doing this. And I'm trying to actually hook myself up with other groups. So anybody's out there listening and they want an old guy bounce stuff off of, I'm out there working at it. But Notes from Underground really is my place. And, you know, of course, White Wave and other podcasts that I do attend and or daily trade sessions because, you know what, you it's too, and I see Larry's group, it's too hard to do it. If you think you can do this by yourself, by generating only your own thoughts, I think you make a mistake. So it's good to have any kind of forum where you can bounce ideas around and work it through.
Awesome. Thank you so much, gentlemen. We'll end it there. Great. And,
thank you, gents. Have a great day.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks, guys.
Okay.